I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 20th of June, the first day of summer. Happy summer. All things political this hour. News this morning that Donald Trump has fired his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. Trump's poll numbers are sinking, and support from big money donors and some members of the Republican establishment dwindling. Our guest this hour, Todd Gitlin, is highly critical of the presumptive Republican nominee and asks, what took journalists so long to rise to the occasion of fact-checking Trump? Interesting article in New York Times from a writer for the Daily Beast. Michael Tomasky writes, last week was an important and even revelatory week in American politics. Contrary to what's been the single most firmly held conviction about this campaign by observers left and right, a terrorist attack did not help the Republican candidate in the race for president. Indeed, it seems to have weakened him. Hillary Clinton is scoping out potential vice presidents. Is Elizabeth Warren high on that list? And would that be a way of winning over Bernie Sanders voters? Gun legislation is before the Senate. Background check systems and restrictions on gun sales for the terror watch list. So it's a busy all things political. And you're invited to call. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Todd Gitlin is a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He's the author of 16 books, many on journalism and politics. He is author of Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. He has taught at a number of important universities. He was the third president of Students for a Democratic Society in 1963-64, and also coordinator of the SDS Peace Research and Education Project. He helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War and the first American demonstrations against corporate aid to the apartheid regime in South Africa. Todd, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Well, let's start with the news that came this morning that Donald Trump has fired his campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. Why do you think he did that? Do we know anything about why he does what he does?
Well, Trump's been a downward spiral, and, whatever it took to get him where he's gotten, Trump, that is, obviously has burned its it's now suffered diminishing returns. And I've been thinking about the larger picture here, and it's very interesting. Here's a different way to think about what's happening. Ever since Reagan, there was a natural order of succession in the Republican Party. It went from Reagan to Bush the elder, and then there were unsuccessful candidates. There was Bob Dole, for example. And as later there was Mitt Romney and John McCain. So the Republican Party is one that has an orderly order of succession. And so you could say it was even dynastic. And I think because the Republicans had so much success, we underestimated, I know I did, the strains within the Republican Party. Because this country's too big and complicated to be a unitary thing, a fist. It's more like a bunch of fingers. And so there was the Christian right part of it. There's the small business anti-regulatory part of it. There's the libertarian part of it. There's the belligerent foreign policy part of it. And Reagan and the Bushes, the older Bush was just a short-term successor, but Reagan and young Bush were straightforward candidates who seemed to embody the various tendencies within that coalition in their own person. Now, what went wrong for them this year? They didn't have that candidate. They didn't have the sort of the personification of the grand coalition. And that's how we ended up with 16 or 17 of these folks up on the stage. Mm-hmm. Now, Lewandowski's emergence as a sort of sidekick to Trump is another sign of the breakdown of the Republican order, because there should have been, under normal circumstances, there would have been the Republican regulars who would have stepped up to manage the campaign. And the Republican regulars, you know, they're tested. They know what they're doing. They know how to create a unity out of an assemblage of disparate parts. They couldn't do it this year. I mean, I suppose Jeb Bush was the automatic dynastic successor, and that didn't play out. So I think that the collapse of the Lewandowski era is in part yet another pointer to a longer-running, at least national, crisis of the Republican Party.
Let's talk. I think this was an important piece that was in the New York Times yesterday, No More Fear. The author talks about, and I want you to comment on this, that observers left and right figured that a terrorist attack would help the Republican candidate in the race for president. Indeed, he writes, it seems to have weakened him. Would you agree with that?
I do. I've had Michael Tomasky is a very shrewd political observer, and I had shared the belief or the illusion that he alludes to, that I think he had earlier shared as well, namely that Republicans always benefit from a sense of threat, from urgent and violent threat. In the polls that I've seen, it hasn't panned out that way, and maybe that Trump is not a plausible leader, a plausible commander. It may be that he actually generates more fear than he calms it. I mean, Reagan calmed fear, George W. Bush calmed fear. Trump sends off alarms, and so that may be what just happened. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it is still early.
Yes, it is still early. Heaven help us. It's going to be a long campaign still. You obviously follow the media very closely, and I want you to spend a little bit of time. You asked the question, why has it taken so long for Republicans and for the media to call Donald Trump on actual racism? Why is it? What happened in this campaign that kept just a number of areas, the lawsuits against him, his use of racial slurs against all kinds of people, how employees were treated. There are just a whole host of issues that everybody seemed late to the game in gathering. Why is that?
I have a piece coming out this week about Trump's relations with mobsters, which is a subject that has been nibbled at here mm-hmm. and there in the media, but hasn't really gotten the big blast of attention I think it will get. Well, for one thing, Trump delivered eyeballs, which is the way TV people talk about what not just about political candidates, but about what their goal is. Their goal is to sell advertising. And Trump, just by virtue of being a television star of his own curious sort, just by virtue of being colorful, he distinguished himself from the field. And so part of what happened, I think, is that they were sort of entranced. I think a second thing that happened, by the way, something similar happened with Reagan in 1980. We tend to think that Reagan was the automatic candidate, but he had rivals, including George H.W. Bush. But Reagan had a certain charm, and Trump's sort of charm is not conventional charm, but it has the same power of diverting attention from the specific claims made by a candidate to his personality. And there are enough Americans who rally to that personality that he was able to dance away from questioning. Now, the questioning was pretty lightweight. It generally is in the primaries, and Trump was able to lie and misstate and utter falsehoods with impunity. Very few of the journalists had done their homework. They were not prepared with follow-up questions. There were excellent exceptions along the way, but for the most part, the fact that Trump had said something meant that he deserved attention, and often. We had the oddity of CNN, for example, not covering a Hillary Clinton rally, right. But covering an empty stage while a Trump rally was in the process of getting itself together. Just the promise of eyeballs was good enough for them. And you have to remember about cable TV. We talk a lot about cable TV and its importance, and it is very important. But the total viewership for the three cable news channels, CNN, Fox, and MSNBC, is about 3 million people. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
But they tend to be quite attuned and enthusiastic. They tend to be regulars. So just getting a big bump up from those viewers didn't require a huge number of people, but it does certainly reward. It warms the hearts of the bean counters, which means the eyeball counters at the networks. So there were a number of things that converged, and I think journalists thought he was a normal sort of candidacy that they could treat in a normal sort of way, which is cavalier, joshing, bantering, not looking too closely, occasionally throwing a spitball, occasionally a gotcha question. So thus we had the rise to fame of Megyn Kelly. And Trump, of course, kept, was a gift who never ceased to give on that score. But they were not prepared for the sheer recklessness, the sheer bravado, and the sheer distortions of this campaign.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you are a professor of journalism, could you comment for just a moment on what you've reminded us of, that the newspaper workforce has shrunk by 20,000 positions, 39% in the last 20 years. Does that have an effect on how carefully a campaign is covered?
Oh, for sure. I mean, one thing that's quickest to go is investigative reporting, because it's labor-intensive. For somebody to conduct an investigation means that he or she has to be taken off a regular beat and basically put in a room somewhere with a researcher to collect information. That can go on for weeks or months. So this is the most expensive kind of reporting. Thus it is, I think, that it's disproportionately been cut. A second thing that's been cut radically is reporting of local and state politics.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go into it in that piece, but other people have written about it before. So whenever you have somebody who has a career either in business or politics that touches on political decisions, then that is going to get short shrift. So, for example, Trump, although not himself running for office, was involved in political decisions in the state of New Jersey having to do with his ability to get a license to operate casinos in Atlantic City. And there's some very interesting and disturbing questions about how he was able to get by circumventing the normal rules for acquiring that sort of license. There were questions about his relation with felons that were, I think, have not been adequately treated, in part because the Albany Bureau, Madison is somewhat different because it's a major city, but most American state capitals are not in major cities. They're in Albany, they're in Trenton, New Jersey, they're in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. You have very small staffs, very few people at work. So all of this, I think, damaged the capacity of the press corps as a whole to address, especially somebody who, although he had a long record in the media, did not have a long trail of a close scrutiny from people who cover politics.
Let's move to the Democratic side, Todd. What happens to the Bernie Sanders movement now? What happens to all those people?
Well, this is one of these emergent phenomena that I don't think we can say yet. I mean, you can certainly see. I can't read this crystal ball. I think that a lot of them will end up grudgingly voting for, even working for Hillary Clinton. I think there'll be a percentage who are unreconciled. They will be like the Naderites of 2000. They will have come to the conclusion that the parties are identical, and they'll drift away. They'll be less than 10% of the Bernie Sanders voters and supporters, maybe a lot less than 10%. Remember, I went to the 2008 Democratic Convention in Denver, and I was, after one of the sessions, I was on a bus back to the hotel with a Hillary Clinton delegate, and she was smoldering. She was furious at Obama. She would never vote for Obama, she said. It was Hillary all the way. She was a union person. She was a delegate. I don't know whether she vented, but I mean, so it was, there was no shortage of anguish, rage, and harsh words for the defeated in that case. So this is not brand new. The question, so I think Hillary will not suffer, but I do think the more forceful question is, can the Bernie movement, which wanted to see itself as a political revolution, can it actually crystallize into an ongoing force?
Mm-hmm.
Can it do the sorts of things that Sanders said the other day he wants them to do? He wants them to vet candidates. He wants them to run for local office. He wants them to raise money. He wants them to converge on a progressive political platform. And in order to do that, you need more than a titular leader. You need an apparatus. So is there a Bernie apparatus? I don't know. I would expect that if it does exist, you'd be seeing more of it in Wisconsin with its progressive tradition than elsewhere. I just don't know.
We're going to welcome phone calls. The Senate will have gun legislation to vote on sometime very soon, background check systems and restrictions on gun sales for people on the terror watch list among the proposals they will be voting on. Is this a time, because you had a combination of a hate crime and a terrorist act in Orlando, when there could be movement, at least on the restrictions on gun sales for the terror watch list, if not the background check system? We'll talk to Todd about that and whatever else happens to be on your minds. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter at Dunn Show. Todd is an American writer, sociologist, communication scholar, author of a number of books, and has a long history in left politics. He was the third president of Students for a Democratic Society and helped organize the first national demonstration against the Vietnam War. To your phone calls momentarily, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. We start our calls with Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Call. I guess, I kind of feel like I'm being force-fed, to accept Elizabeth Warren as, every newscast starts off with, oh, what's Elizabeth Warren doing visiting Hillary's campaign headquarters? I'm a Bernie supporter, have been for a year now. The fastest way to win me over is to make him her vice presidential running mate. Why would you not? He brings the honesty factor that, like it or not, or rightfully or wrongfully, she seems to be lacking in the minds of a lot of people. I think he brings the dynamic, the way he speaks is very dynamic. He's got a lot of followers, obviously. He's very charismatic, and I think he helps to balance that out. I know of Trump supporters who have already told me if he is her running mate, they will switch sides and come over because they feel like he is the alternate establishment candidate, and they would be accepting enough of that to vote for Hillary.
Todd.
Well, I don't know. I wasn't aware that so much attention was being paid to Elizabeth Warren nowadays. I mean, I think if she had run for the presidency, she would have started with a bump up above where Bernie Sanders did, because she, being a woman in politics and being so outspoken during the aftermath of the financial crisis, she would benefit from the dog bites man or dog bites woman phenomenon, where journalists are interested in somebody who's different. About the vice presidency, I don't have any particular views.
You wouldn't like to see Sanders on the ticket?
I don't know whether they play well with each other. Some people who like Bernie's politics a lot don't think that he's the most collaborative fellow in the world. I think he would probably help her in some of the hard-pressed states in the Midwest, but I don't know that he would help her in other battleground states, you know, of Florida, Virginia, North Carolina, that sort of thing. I mean, that's above my pay grade.
Okay. Patty on Facebook writes, the media doesn't present enough coverage of the nature of the disaffection of the Trump and Sanders supporters. The former is looking to take us back to a time when America was great. The latter is offering a hopeful vision of the future, but the middle class and the poor continue to struggle and can see wealth continuing to track upward.
Well, this is an interesting thing. Quite early, we started hearing the media story that the Trump movement, if we can speak of it, the people who were going to the rallies were disfranchised, laid off, dispossessed, white working class men. And indeed, that's a hunk of the Trump support. But it was generally not sufficiently reported that there was just as large a group of people with a relatively high education level, also white, largely male as well, who were not themselves suffering personally in the way that the first group were. So, in other words, I think the failure with respect to the Trump movement was not understanding how ideological it was. That it was primarily a nativist reaction. It was a reaction of white people who feel that the America that was great and needs to be made great again was basically, they wouldn't come out and say it, a white America. So I think that was a serious failing. We looked at elements of personality, we looked at elements of strategy and horse race and so on, rather than what's going on in the country, which is, by the way, not so different from what's going on in most of the developed world. That is, it's a recoil against an economic and political situation in which people feel embattled. There are all these foreigners who are coming in on them, and they resent it. They don't feel properly sheltered, including some of those people you just mentioned, Kathleen, for part of your second hour, people who were gone home to live with their
parents.
So, and that wasn't supposed to be the story of their lives. So these people are displaced, dislodged, thrashing around. Some of them go right, some go left. In Europe, many more of them are going right than left, and I fear it's actually easier to recruit such people into what's basically a nationalist force than into a progressive force, but we'll see.
Thanks, Mike, for your call. Let's go next to Ed in West Dallas. Hi.
Well, the good professor forgot one wing of the Republican Party in his analysis, and that's the union-hating, union-busting wing represented by our $2 million in debt former candidate for president, Scott Walker, now our governor. And the reason why we in organized labor are so conflicted here are five letters, NAFTA. And that is going to be the albatross around Hillary's neck. We don't trust her. Just as we don't trust her husband, because who gave us NAFTA. And last week we had this endorsement by Trumka on Thursday. He got nothing in return for the endorsement. There were no promises on the Employee Free Choice Act. There were no promises on labor law reform. There were no promises on the National Labor Relations Board reform. And I'm telling you today that it is going to be a very hard sell. We would rather vote for Gus Hall than for Hillary Clinton.
John.
Well, thank you for that. I think that this is an important thing. And the seeping away of jobs, especially well-paid, enduring jobs, is an old story. It's been happening in America for decades. It preceded NAFTA. NAFTA accelerated it to some degree, and other trade deals have done likewise. But I take your point for sure that if Hillary Clinton cannot offer a convincing program for dealing with the ebbing away of especially of manufacturing jobs, she is starting, she's dug a hole. And it's not a matter of trusting her, in my view. I mean, we're talking here about politics, not about marriage or other kinds of personal relations. We're talking about how does a candidate get to be made responsible to a constituency. And the union movement, weakened as it's been, has not, along with a lot of other sectors of the society, has not been able to deliver the goods. It's not been able to bargain properly with the politicians in office. And so, yes, it did succumb to the NAFTA agreement, which, let's face it, I mean, that was Bill Clinton's doing, not Hillary's. But in any case, you know, it's understandable that she wouldn't be trusted. But what I'm talking about is an approach to politics in which we don't sit back and wait for somebody to ride in on a horse and say, that's our person, that's our guy or our gal. No, you can't. That's not politics. That's fantasy. What real politics has to do with getting in there, getting people elected at local levels, defeating the Scott Walkers of the world, and assembling a coalition alliance with punch.
When you, it's interesting you mentioned Hillary not having anything to do with NAFTA. People are going to and have already talked about the possibility that she will have an administration that is either similar to what her husband had, which was fairly centrist, or she will have something that is much more liberal. Where do you fall on that? What sense has she given you about where she's going?
Well, certainly Bernie has pushed her to the left. I mean, in so many areas, infrastructure spending, clean energy, trade deals, so just three major areas, retraining and so on. I mean, if she is elected and she does try to redo the 90s, I think she'd be making a huge mistake, because the anger, the wrath that's poured forth from the people who were dispossessed and walked on, that's not going away. I mean, it's a fixture. It's built in. It's built into the fact that we are a sort of semi plutocracy. And if she thinks, you know, this is the time for the second coming of Robert Rubin, she's going to have. I can't believe she would be that stupid. But if she did, I think she would very soon find herself in a less than beautifully governable situation.
Ed, thanks for the call. Richard in Fort Atkinson, hello.
Hi, thank you very much. My forebears came here during the collapse of Weimar. Later on, when I was young, I was in the Wisconsin STS and had a particular enthusiasm for our contacts with the Chicago Panthers. We were scared out of our heads when Fred Hampton was assassinated. This progression seems now to have been revitalized, and there has been, I think, a suspicion of real dissenting opinion. You don't hear Chomsky, you don't hear any of the dissenting voices who really take a critical view of what the Obama administration has been doing, especially people like Snowden. Now, Hillary and Obama and young Bush are the triumvirate that changed this place into a full-blooded, legalized surveillance state. We have made the Stasi in East Germany look like amateurs. Nobody except some of the people on the left who have no voice at all are willing to speak upon that.
Todd.
Well, I don't know how you can say that we have a
whoops, wait a second. Hello? Are you there, Todd?
Hi.
There
Hello?
We go. Okay. Yeah, okay. We lost you for a minute.
I don't know how you can say that we have a more intrusive surveillance state than East Germany. I mean, that's a statement of extraordinary ignorance. They were keeping smears of people's sweat when they sat on the seats and Stasi headquarters so that they could, that was sort of better than fingerprints. Look, Bernie Sanders is a dissident, and he's had his say, and he's certainly not an apologist for the American oligarchy. I don't know what his views are on Snowden and other such matters of surveillance, but, you know, those are just some issues. Moreover, since I gather we're of the same generation, we lived through the Nixon years, I don't know how you could conceivably say that what either Clinton or Obama had put together by way of surveillance comes anywhere near the sort of crypto-fascist approach to dissidents that was characteristic of the Nixon years. And, you know, you mentioned the assassination of Fred Hampton, who was the Illinois chief of Black Panther Party in 1969. There we had an assassination carried out by Chicago police with the help of the FBI. I'm not complacent about the state of things in America, but we're not getting those assassinations. So, you know, I think the exaggeration is not helpful.
Let's finish to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. I'm enjoying this program immensely, as usual. My question is, I heard that the problem that Elizabeth Warren has, and it's the same problem for the senator of the same basic wing of the party, is it Senator Whitehouse from Ohio, is that in both cases they have Republican governors who would obviously not be appointing Democrats to the seat, to the vacant seat, but that Al Franken in Minnesota is also quite progressive and very well respected and has a Democrat governor. And I'd just like to know if Todd knows, has any inkling of whether Franken is on the short list.
I have no inside information. I haven't seen his name mentioned, but that doesn't mean anything one way. I share your approval of him, and I think it is a serious consideration when you think about Sherrod Brown, for example, in Ohio, that if he ran for vice president, that it would be a Republican. He's one of the more reliably progressive members of the Senate, so that would be at a time when the election of a Democratic Senate is more important than ever. I think that's a negative mark on the list. But I don't know if Al Franken is interested, and I haven't heard his name mentioned, but all I know is what I read in the papers.
Yeah. Thanks, Scott. And we don't have as many reporters, so it's not as complete as it ought to be, right? Scott, thanks very much for the call. I do want to spend at least a moment talking about the aftermath of Orlando, and once again, we are looking at possible gun legislation. The Senate will be voting sometime this week. Last week it appeared that Republicans and Democrats were both saying, listen, we just can't have people who are on a terror watch list have access to these kinds of weapons. There seemed to be a lot of agreement on that. Does that portend that the Senate will vote aye when it comes to restricting gun sales for terror watch list people? And what about the background check system? I would imagine that's going nowhere. Do you disagree?
Well, I'm interested in the. I mean, it's been pointed out that not everybody on the watch list deserves to be there, and there's been some pretty wide publicity about people who were kept off planes. For example, Laura Poitras, the previous caller mentioned Edward Snowden. She's the filmmaker who went to record him, work with him, and so on. She was having a lot of trouble getting on a plane for a long time. So I don't know that the watch list is the all-perfect screen to be used, and that's where we get above my pay grade again. I don't know how to define a category of people who are dangerous and a waiting period that suffices. Certainly the 72 hours that the killer in Orlando was able to exploit won't do. I mean, I think this is it's a difficult problem, but it's not a wicked problem. It's a solvable problem. If it was agreed that there are too many super powerful guns out there in too many hands of too many people who have not demonstrated that they know how to use them or have a reason to use them, whereas if you have to be licensed to drive a car, don't you need to be licensed to operate an AR-15 semi-automatic machine gun? I mean, I think there are a whole lot of people of goodwill could solve this problem.
Let's go to Jim in Rice Lake next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I just wanted to respectfully disagree with your guest analysis of Hillary having to go to the left to accommodate the Sanders followers. I think with the reality of the gerrymandered House of Representatives, Wisconsin probably being the finest example due to a Republican Party holding the both houses in 2010 with the help of Alec, Hillary will be stuck in a center a center, maybe mild left gridlock that Obama has. I'd just like to hear your guest comment about that point.
It's a good question. I think the House is pretty much a lost cause this time around, for the reason you say. A lot of it has to do with the concentration of Democratic votes in small districts, that is, geographically small cities, in other words, and the Republican gerrymandering and so on. I don't think that goes for the Senate. I think the prospect, from what I read, again, I don't have any, I'm not privy to any special information, but it would look as though the Senate is a more viable proposition for the Democrats. I just want to add one other thing about the pressures on Hillary to move her right or left. I mean, certainly there will be pressures to move her to the right as well, and she is, I think, natively cautious. But she's also natively crusading. I mean, we tend to forget Hillary Clinton, the young Methodist who threw herself into civil rights and anti-war protest in the 1960s. We tend to forget. I mean, to me, one of the most interesting moments in the primaries was when, at the end of one of the Democratic debates, a reporter asked Hillary and Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley, so what do we have? Say something about some issue we haven't talked about. So she went off into a speech about Flint and the poisoning of the water, which I thought was remarkable because it was so impassioned. I don't know if she was sort of sitting on it, ready to roll it out, or whether it was spontaneous. But it was sort of it said to me that you know, that person is still there. And you know, Bernie is right about one thing, many things, but one thing he's right about is that it does take a political revolution to make substantial reforms. I don't think we yet know what a political revolution would be. It doesn't mean just voting for the president or voting one time. It means continuing committed work to change the center of gravity, to put people in office, to coordinate political programs, and so on. I mean, electing Hillary would be only one move in a long game.
Mm-hmm. Were you a part of a political revolution in the 60s, Todd?
Well, yeah. I mean, it took a different form. I mean, it was in the streets. I was one who, I think, stupidly thought in 1968 that when Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey were running, that it didn't make sense to vote. And so we got Nixon and seven more years of war. Certainly there were highly objectionable aspects of the Humphrey campaign, and he was a weakling, and he was bad on the war. But he would have been better. He would have been better in the war. A lot fewer Vietnamese people would have died, and a lot fewer burglaries would have been undertaken by FBI men. So I think, you know, politics is not just there for the satisfaction of some of us. Politics is a complicated game full of lots of human beings with conflicting motives and who don't necessarily like or even abide each other, but have to find some principle for common work. And so once again, we're in a situation where the ideal, the angel is not running.
Ted Gitlin is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political. He's a professor of journalism and sociology and chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. Our phone number, Jim, thanks for your call, is 800-486-8655. We have a lot of emails coming in, Facebook posts too, if you want to write down what you're thinking there. That would be good. The Kathleen Dunn Show. Back to you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gary on Facebook, Todd writes, I would hypothesize that the goal of the liberal media was to ensure Trump was the Republican nominee to help secure the election of Hillary Clinton. No sense in wasting their ammunition and attacks during the primary and have a stronger, more traditional Republican nominee emerge to run against Clinton. Todd. Hello, Todd. Hello. Well, I guess I'll have to read that again for him. And we're welcoming phone calls for Todd Gitlin. We just lost the phone connection here for a moment, so we will get it back on. And we're talking about a number of issues this hour. We're looking, of course, at the presidential race. Donald Trump seems to be really falling in the polls and has said some controversial things about, well, a lot of things, but most recently about Obama and you know, those weird comments were led by a man that either is not tough, not smart, or he's got something else in mind. It's very odd language. There's something going on. It's inconceivable there's something going on. He doesn't get it, or he gets it better than anybody else. It's one or the other, and either one is unacceptable. Todd, are you there?
Yeah, I'm
oh,
here.
Good.
I heard the question. Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's... there is no cabal of liberal media. There are rational business people who have some additional values, and they make judgments about what's going to collect their audience. So in that sense, yes, there was a swerve toward Trump because he was so entertaining. But to think that there was, on the part of the media mogul, some deliberate decision that Trump would be a patsy for Democrats just flies in the face of reason. Many of these people are as voters. Maybe the moguls are as voters are Republicans. They are business people, and so they're not diabolically ideological beyond trying to preserve their own economic position in society.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned those Donald Trump comments that were so bizarre, you know, one step beyond the whole birther movement. It's just so conspiratorial here, isn't it? The way he says, you know, people can't believe it. They can't believe the way he's acting, insinuating that he's one of them, one of those Muslim terrorists. It's just bizarre to me.
Yeah, there's this long tendency in American life. A great historian, Richard Hofstadter, wrote about this more than 50 years ago. The paranoid strain in American politics goes way back. Nativism, you know, revulsion against immigrants and so on goes back to the 1830s. In fact, it goes back earlier. There was a period when Benjamin Franklin himself said we shouldn't let any more Germans into Pennsylvania because they're swarthy. So Trump's in a tradition. What's peculiar is the sheer volume of the accusations, which are, I think, you know, I think it has to be said, often quite ingenious. I mean, the whole Born in Kenya movement, you know, is an outpouring of hysteria, and I mean, I think people who watch the world in its chaotic way, fail to make sense, like to think that somewhere there's a rational brain or a conclave of rational brains, wicked but rational, who sit in a room somewhere and make these decisions. And, you know, it's sort of curious given how many people believe this sort of thing. I mean, I think tens of millions of Americans, and not just America, I think this tendency is everywhere. It's peculiar. They never quite come up with the evidence. So it's a sort of moving target. You say, well, he was born in, you know, he doesn't have his birth certificate. So then he produces his birth certificate. So do you change what you were saying? No, you just go on and you throw up something else about his Kenyan background. And we're talking here about a fixed idea that's impervious to evidence. And God knows there's a lot of it. I mean, George Bush, the young Bush, did the same thing with respect to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, so much so that after the invasion of Iraq, not only did many of the supporters of the war believe that there had been weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but many of them actually believed they had been found, which was a complete falsehood. But this is a, you know, this is a trick of the mind to convince yourself that the world is consistent. So if you said there were weapons of mass destruction and now there are none, well, they must have been there and must have been found and done away with because we did the right thing by invading Iraq. Mm-hmm. This is
a sort of caricature of reason.
Karen in Madison, hi.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a question about gun control in this country versus Europe. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, last week, right after the attacks in Orlando, there were two highly public political murders in Europe, one of a Labor MP and one of a Paris policeman mm-hmm. who was undercover. Now, both of these murders primarily occurred by knife. The MP was also shot, but the gentleman had to make a gun. He found it so difficult to obtain a weapon in Britain. And I think that these laws give the public an inherent advantage in Europe that we don't have. You know, if you have to approach someone with a knife, you can't do an impulse killing. You can't, you know, just grab something and do domestic violence. The victim has a little more warning, and I wish that we could have that kind of public safety in America. A gun is something you can do, but from a distance, you can get off far more shots, and I was wondering what your commentator thinks of this.
You're absolutely right. I mean, you can't kill 49 people over a period of hours with a knife, or even two knives, and... you know, the political violence and other, you know, lethal violence in America is so far off the charts of any other country in America, in the world, that to leave no doubt that while it is certainly true that people with bad motives kill people, what they use mostly to kill people is guns. That's a no-brainer.
Howard in Fox City. Hi, Howard.
Hi. I was listening to Ted speaking about it would take a political revolution, which would be take continued voting to change our government. And I recently published a book called How to Replace Congress, where the Constitution actually has it spelled out that senators have term limits. And most people, I just want to share that Article 1, Section 3, Clause 2 says that senators are in three classes, and in 2016, Class 3 senators, 34 of them, their seats expire. Well, what the Constitution says is upon expiration of your class, your office shall be vacated. Now, if in fact the voters took that to heart, we could replace one-third of Congress every 2 years, having a new government every six.
I must say I haven't heard that mentioned before. How about you, Todd?
Well, I think what that provision of the Constitution means is that when the term is over, that is to say in January after the election, that it then must be replenished with newly elected people who may be the same as the old people. But in any case, the 101st Congress becomes the 102nd Congress and so on. So, no, it doesn't mean that... that there are term limits.
Let's go to Richard in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Regarding the person who is a strong union member and condemnatory of Hillary, state legislatures across this country, at least in 20 states, are essentially the pawns of ALEC.
That's true. ALEC is a right-wing association that funds legislation and elects members of state legislatures. And there are, moreover, I think there are 30 states that have a Republican governor. So, yes, they have devoted themselves to building this machinery and passing legislation, including legislation that curbs voting rights, all of which is deleterious to democracy, and they have not been combated by an equally resolute, equally funded counter.
Thanks, Richard, very much for your call. What a time we're living in, huh, Todd? It's just been, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you said it.
Really. Thank you so much for being with us. Join us again
soon. Very
well.
Okay. All the best.
And to you, too. Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism, sociology, chair of the PhD program in communications at Columbia University. He's written a number of books. history of the 60s, one of them, lots of books on journalism and politics, and he's currently writing a novel, The Opposition. He was a very big activist back in the 1960s, anti-Vietnam War activist, demonstration organizer, and also worked against the apartheid regime in South Africa. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers for producing The Hour, and thanks to Carrie Salinas for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls and for listening, everybody. Stay with us. We're going to talk about why so many millennials are living with their parents. Hour 2.